So my name is Maroi Ejide, and I've always been a lover of fiction and writing in one way or another ever since I was a little kid. I think I've enjoyed languages, different ways of communicating the most. So I didn't start off saying I wanted to be a writer one day, but I knew that I did like words and that I wanted to work with words and enjoyed working with words. So throughout my career, I guess you could say it started with, I started as a researcher in Washington, D.C., working in consulting companies, looking at different technologies, and that expanded into teaching technical writing many years later. And then eventually I tried my hand at fiction writing. It was always something I enjoyed doing kind of on the side. And then I started writing quietly when I was pregnant with my third son. A lot of quiet time, a lot of late nights. I was up a lot. I tend to be a very light sleeper on the insomniac side, so that goes very well with writing. I started with short stories, publishing short stories here and there, and that began to gain momentum. And then I began to expand out the concept of my first novel that was published, which was called Time of the Locust. And so I guess you could say it was, in one way or another, a 10-year overnight success. Life definitely got in the way sometimes in good ways and in not so good ways. So I rode around life, and here I am.
Now, you're a native of Washington, D.C., correct?
Yes.
But you have some roots in Kalamazoo as well. Can you tell us about that part of your life?
Oh, sure. Well, I have a lot of happy memories of Michigan and Kalamazoo College. As I had said earlier, I always had a love of languages. Particularly, Kalamazoo College had a wonderful Japanese studies program. I had been studying French in high school, and then I began studying Japanese informally with a good buddy of mine in high school. And so it started off as a fun interest that I had. And Kalamazoo College, coincidentally at the time, had it's always had a stellar international program, but it had a fantastic Japanese studies program. So I applied particularly for that program so I could do the foreign study where you go overseas. I went for a year. That's one of the wonderful specialties that Kalamazoo College offers, a fantastic international element to their curriculum. So at Kalamazoo College, I was introduced to the wonderful world of not only foreign studies, but literature, social sciences, political sciences. So it was a great, great all-around experience. I think it had a lot to do with the richness of my experiences and the levels of looking at things in different ways. And that's one of the things I'll always love about Kalamazoo College.
Now, there was I'm not sure if it's still going on, a seminar about autism. I believe it was taught by Bruce Mills. Did you,
yes,
by any chance have any exposure to that? Did that have any effect on your decision to write about autism in this debut novel?
I didn't. And at the time, this was many, many moons ago when I was in Kalamazoo College back in the early 90s. So that fast forward to 2010, when I started Time of the Locust, the interest in autism came from an entirely different direction. However, ironically, I did connect with Bruce Mills almost by accident on Facebook, and we've become marvelous, marvelous Facebook friends. He's been a wonderful supporter in recent year or two. So I look at that as a wonderful happy ending, closing the loop But no, it wasn't a direct link in that way. However, we did end up reconnecting years later.
Time of the Locust is the novel that we're talking about. Give us an idea of what this book is about. And it's a wonderful read. I've read it recently and enjoyed it immensely. You're a wonderful writer and you just received an award, so you can tell us about that as well. But give our listeners an idea of the book plot.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, Time of the Locust is a magical realism, literary fiction type of novel, and it tells the story of a 7-year-old autistic boy who's at the center of the story. His name is Sefiri, and it tells a story of him and a supernatural relationship that he has with his incarcerated father. His father is in a supermax facility in Colorado, and so we get a image of an American family in the sense that it's told from the different points of view of his mom, Brenda, who's raising him as a single mom. And this child has created a sort of dichotomy of sorts to process his world. He's nonverbal. So he calls the real world the land of air. And that's where he finds a lot of his challenges in navigating and communicating and getting his feelings understood, his wants and needs understood. And then the other side that he's created is called the world of water. And this is his internal world that he's created, filled with all of the magic and fantasy of undersea creatures who can understand him. So it's a way that he's made sense of his inner world. Time of the Locust at its core is about hidden worlds, many different kinds of prisons that people either are unwillingly put in or also types of prisons that they've imposed on themselves in one way or another. So we see that through the mom, Brenda, and some of the other characters. And we see physical prisons and mental prisons. So it's a study, a window, if you will, into what those inner worlds might look like, and ultimately how the characters in this family transcend those barriers and those things that bind them and find a way to each other.
One of the things that struck me when I was reading this book was this writer has courage to take on not just one or two big issues. You've taken on a whole mountain of issues. Like you said, autism, incarceration, single parenthood, divorce, murder, racism, obesity, mythology. There must have been an incredible mountain to climb here of research that you had to do. Tell us a little bit about that research. Did you spend time with families dealing with autism? Did you spend time talking to people who had been in solitary confinement? How did you get so into the skin of your characters?
Well, I think it's writing for me is a real odyssey, and it's a real adventure, and I look at it as such from the very, very beginning. I didn't start off with the concept of autism directly. I did start off with the concept of looking at different kinds of ways that people communicate, and I believe that there's a certain language of the heart. So I started there. I'm a mom myself. I have 3 children of my own. So I looked at, I called them pillars, if you will, conceptually in the story. So we have what does parenthood look like? What does childhood look like? What does being in a place you don't want to be look like? And what is being in a place you do want to be look like? So if you look at it in very a sort of a constellation of ideas, I expanded that out in a very organic way. And going back to the very, very beginning of what sparked the idea of Time of the Locust, it was simply a photograph that I came across completely by accident. Picture of a child. It was an article about autism. I always look at various articles. I like to read a lot. And I saw this photograph, and this kid was looking out of the window at a at a tree, and he had this wonderful, fantastical type of look on his face, on especially in his eyes. And I just looked at his eyes and thought for a second, wow, I wonder what his inner world looks like. Now, that in itself was how the book began in my mind. And then from there, of course, there's many, many, many things written about autism, but I was struck by the fact that there's actually there's a lot that's still not understood about autism. So as a writer and basically as an explorer of human behavior, I wanted to look at if we could get a glimpse of what that inner world might be, what might that look like? So the research began from there. And yes, I did read a lot of letters from parents of children with autism. I looked at a lot of video blogs. And the beautiful thing about parents in general, I think, is they support each other. They communicate with each other, parent to parent. And so I found that many parents were very, very open with me in terms of what their day looks like. What does autism look like for them? What does parenthood look like for them? On the flip side, it was a similar process with solitary confinement, looking at Supermax. There are some things written about Supermax, but very little is told from the actual point of view of someone in Supermax. A lot is censored. So there again, there was the question in my mind, hey, if we could get a glimpse of that, what might that look like? So there's a lot of extrapolating going on. I read a lot of letters of the ones that weren't censored anyway, of people who are incarcerated. And it began to paint a certain picture in my mind of a world within the world of the United States. I think you can't talk about America without talking about the prison system. You can't talk about a family without talking about each member of the family and how the dynamic of each member plays into how that family works or doesn't work, how they find their way or don't find their way. So those were the things that I explored in Time of the Locust.
You're right. In the United States, I believe our prison system is, if not the largest, one of the largest in the world. With solitary confinement, did you find through these letters that it's pretty typical for an inmate to go through some kind of a mental breakdown, or almost, if not a mental breakdown, perhaps to go places in the mind when you're confined physically?
I actually got more of a sense of what goes on, not from reports in the United States, but reports done by other countries about the penal system in the United States. Those reports seem to be much more frank, if you will, in their examination. I think part of the imaginary process when you're a fiction writer is you have to work at empathy, being an empath to the 10th power or to the best of your ability to really try to gather the seeds of what something is like for someone when they're experiencing something. I think I try to look at each of the characters in terms of human behavior. So I did read a lot of psychology materials. But I think, you know, at a certain point, you set the research aside and you look at people. How do people behave? How might someone in this particular situation behave? And that's the stance I try to take with each of the characters in the book, not just the prisoners, but also the warden, the guards. I looked at not just the mom, but her neighbors, and how others treated her. I tried to look at not just the child Safiri as an object, other people looking at this kid, but also from an inside looking out point of view. And I think that may be, the book has been very well received. It received a 2012, it was a finalist for the Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction. And then this year it was a NAACP Image Award nominee for outstanding fiction. So those are very, very different accolades, if you will. And I think it speaks to the fact that people look at this book from many different points of view. I feel like literature at its best, a story at its best, is like a hologram, and you can turn it different ways and see different things. And that's the effect that I was going for with the Time of the Locust. I think there's a certain flexible quality to the story, if you will, that allows the reader to go on a journey with that character, but to find their own understanding in the story as well.
So talk to me about the motif of locusts. We tend to think of, I would think most people think of locusts with a biblical context, that they symbolize impending disaster, but mm-hmm. not sure at all that you meant it that way in your book. What's the idea with the locusts?
Well, you're right. That is the traditional point of view or impression when you hear that. And I was playing on that concept itself. I really wanted to turn that on its head and look at locusts. I'll back up a little bit. I was the kid in high school that watched Nova episodes and nature episodes, and I was always fascinated by the natural world and different cycles. Locust, again, that's one of those interesting creatures that have a dormant cycle. And what lies dormant is one of the key symbols in Time of the Locust. You have characters with hidden greatness and abilities lying dormant. You have ways that people hide their lives underground in one way or another. Locust having that idea of coming up out of the ground, coming up out of something that we may not have known that they had been there for all that time. So I used it as a motif throughout the story to kind of mimic in a way the human spirit, how it might lie dormant for any number of years or decades, but at some point it rises up and transcends, and it becomes a way of finding its own, it finds its own path. So it is very symbolic, but I had a lot of fun with the idea of locust, and the locust in the particular locust, the mountain locust that's referenced in the book, that is actually a real type of locust that is now extinct, but it did have a particularly long cycle where it was dormant, and then it would come up. So again, another fun part of fiction is you can really use the world and as your toolkit, things you find, things you come across, research that sparks your interest in something, and human interaction all come into play. They're all elements when you're putting a story together. And that's what I tried to do in Time of the Locust.
And you did it well. We'd love to hear an excerpt. Could you read to us just a little bit from your novel?
Sure. This small excerpt is taken from the point of view of the little boy, Safiri. There were many things that frustrated Safiri about being in the land of air. He couldn't stand the different regimens and schedules that were not of his own making, how the people were always telling and talking and asking, until it all became a sort of noise that ran together in his head. Not like the grandfather clock at the end of the hallway, though. He loved to watch the pendulum swing and listen to the tick-tock, tick-tock in the quiet of the night. The ticks and tocks knew their order. They understood their place. He liked to press his ear to its mechanics, its genius and symmetry. The sound was like his favorite shape, a cube, a shape of perfection, with its height, width, depth, balanced against itself, whole and complete, like the night, like the dark in the coat closet. Sometimes he was able to enter and close the door before his mother could catch him. And he was encased. He was protected by the sublimity of height, width, depth. That was how everything should be.